and is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you that views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and the views of our callers. Of course, our call telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have this Bill Sardi, and I think we're going to be talking about the avian influenza this evening. Now, many of the people I know and respect really believe that we have a real potential problem from avian influenza. Myself, I think we're being hyped by the controlled media, and they're creating fears for obvious reasons. There's an agenda. I've never seen anything quite like this. And if you stop and think that the chances of you getting hit lightning in the United States and killed is about 160 every year. 160 Americans will get hit by lightning and killed every year. How many Americans have died of avian influenza? And as you're going to learn this evening, why this the virus has been around since 1959. It's certainly been people had it. It's in 1997, 98, somewhere in there, but. Thing is that I think we should be prepared. I think we should be prepared because there are lots of things that could happen. We live in a very uncertain world. But with that as a background, Bill Sardi, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you. And, of course, this flu story won't go away. It seems like the public, it's not on high on their interest list, and yet the news media keeps reporting it like it's an imminent danger. And all over the world, if you're adept enough to sign up on Google to have every flu report sent to your desk on your computer, you'll see that they're occurring rapidly and readily every day in every country. And, of course, this goes on and on. It seems to be like a concerted effort. And, of course, we bring up, of course, that something's wrong here. And, of course, I have a report being posted on my website. And we're trying to bring to the public's attention the things that they're not hearing, of course, about this whole flu story. And, of course, the topic of our report, what they're not telling you about the predicted flu epidemic. And as I dug into this story, I became aware of something suddenly just didn't make any sense. And it's the story from last week where the National Center for Health Statistics was saying there was a drop in the mortality rate, and they published a chart. But on the chart, there was a rise in the death rate in the United States between 1992 and 93, and it was a severe, abrupt rise in the death rate. I don't know if any listeners tonight can recall some major mortality, some major disease or problem that occurred in 1992-93. It just doesn't ring a bell, I don't think, in anybody's memory bank. It didn't in mine. When they're talking about the flu, they're talking about 500,000 Americans dying in 1918. They're talking about the Asian flu in 1957-58 and the Hong Kong flu in 1968-69, and then there was a little Russian flu outbreak in 1977-78. What was 1992 and 1993? It was a flu outbreak, but the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, doesn't even mention it. No one mentions it in any of their stories that it was one of the major flu epidemics of our time, and yet there it is on the charts. And I could only recognize it by the fact that it was an abrupt rise on the chart until I went to go look what caused it. Then I found out it was a flu pandemic at the time and only lasted 1 year. Well, it was just in our country. And, of course, the bigger story here is, why did they overlook it? Why do they never mention it? Well, about the same number of people got the flu, but more died. 93,000 more people died that year of all causes than the previous year, most of it being the rise was the flu. And of course, as you look at the data, it becomes startling because they don't even mention this, and what happens is that most of this occurred in nursing homes. And of course, who are the most vulnerable but the elderly? They have a weakened immune system. And so we get into the effectiveness of vaccines, and we realize that we may be vaccinated, but there are people that don't get vaccinated. And most likely, they're the frail elderly that can't get out to the vaccination stations, and they may be in nursing homes. But even the data shows in nursing homes where they had a high vaccination rate and they had even pre-inoculated them with Tamiflu, there were deaths in those nursing homes and a massive pandemic. Do the vaccines work? We have to question this. And now, researchers, of course, at the National Institutes of Health are pointing out the vaccines haven't been working for years. It's right in a major medical journal. And what they're pointing out is most of the immunity and the low rates of death and infection from influenza over the past few years have been acquired by being exposed to similar viruses in other seasons in the past. Well, what are we taking the vaccines for? You see, what they're doing here and why this is all on such a world scale is every season they coach us into some sort of a frenzy because the government is the public relations agency. They buy the vaccines, pay the drug companies money, who pay them back in political payoffs, and then, of course, they've got to get it sold because this is something where the public puts in their $10 bill for. And, of course, lines up at the flu vaccine station. So this is the very thing, is that every year they've got to sell it, where now you can kind of get the hint that what their goal is 100 million vaccine shots that are given out every year in the United States out of a population of 280 million. Well, if there was going to be a pandemic, what about the other 180 million? That don't get vaccinated.
Hold that thought right there, Bill. We'll be back in just a moment with the rest of our... Well, this is Dr. Stan. Go right ahead, Bill.
Well, all the they're really trying to do here is sell vaccine shots. They're not really trying to lower the death rate. And what we're trying to point out is you can get the country vaccinated, and you may even have a lower rate of infection, but the same number of people will likely die, and that's because they're unlikely either to get the shots, or the shots are probably not even going to work. And it'll be the frail elderly that are most at risk. They have the weakened immune system, and this is what the data is showing us from the 1992-93 increase in the mortality rate, the flu outbreak then, that is not even referred to in all the major stories about this, is that it was really a mortaldemic. That is, the mortality rate went way up, but the number of people who got the flu is about the same. And I'm wondering why they never mentioned this one. And, of course, here's our experts from the National Institutes of Health telling us that the vaccines don't work. Now, there was a vaccine that was actually given out in 1997-98, and those in that report, it was saying that the flu vaccine was so ineffective that year that it was probably very close to what would have occurred had no vaccine been available. Of course, no one was ever told about that one. These vaccines are ineffective. What they're giving credit to the vaccine for is acquired from natural immunity by being exposed to these viruses in past seasons and having, of course, an acquired immunity over time. And, of course, this is what's going on. You and I hear every day that the most dangerous flu bug is something called the H5N1, the bird flu. And that's exactly what H5N1 is, a bird flu.
In other words, it's something birds get but human beings don't get ordinarily.
Very few human beings have gotten it. And, of course, we just think of it as something new. It's actually been in circulation in the birds since 1959. They admitted this last week. Now, that's over four decades. of the birds having it. We don't see the birds dying off in mass, nor do we see humans. Also, the humans have had this at least, from what we can tell, maybe earlier, but since 1997. Now, we've got about 9 years there. And in that time, we have, I believe, 100 and some people have died. But they're all poultry workers. They're people that have, third world countries that come in very close contact to the birds. They have poor nutrition, poor immunity. We're doing nothing for them, by the way, except treating them after they get sick. But even the ones that have gotten sick, we've only got a couple of hundred confirmed cases of this. So after 9 years, this is what we get. It does not transfer from human to human, but it could get transferred one time from the bird to the human. We don't have any human-to-human transfer. Now, there have been a couple of suspected cases. The World Health Organization experts have said this is patient one, like the one who got it after from another human. But it's fizzled, just like SARS fizzled. And, of course, the public kind of doesn't hear this. It's not in, you know, you really have to go digging for these numbers and these stories. And which strain of the virus has killed, of influenza virus, has killed the most people, let's say, in the last 20, 30 years? It's not H5N1. It's got something called H3N2. Which has killed over 500,000 Americans, I don't know how many worldwide. It's the prevalent flu strain. And by the way, most of the time, every year, they have the vaccine includes three types of protection from three strains of the virus, and that's usually in there. And people still get it, by the way, meaning there are sub-variants of those viruses. And, of course, that's what we're talking about. What is the Spanish flu? That's really H1N1, which has occurred a number of times over the past couple of decades. It's not the exact same strain, but it is the same type of virus, an influenza A of the H class, H1N1, and then it'll have a subvariant. Well, the subvariant tells us a lot because influenza viruses mutate so fast. You really can't create a vaccine that works. If you're making it 6 months ahead of time or whatever you're doing, these viruses are mutating so fast. And that's exactly what happened in this massive increase of death in 1992-93. The flu season started off normal. There weren't a lot of deaths. Young people were getting it. It was a different strain of the flu. And then it moved to this other form, H3N2, and then it took off. But only because it got to a vulnerable population. For the rest of us, we're not at risk. I've said this, and it's in our report going to be at knowledgeofhealth.com. And what we've said is that if they're going to have the quarantines that they're threatening us with, what they really need to do is encircle the nursing homes with police and make sure nobody gets in. Because if we've got the flu, certainly don't let the people in the nursing homes get it. So, you know, what's going to happen, and we're going to give you further evidence here in a moment, it's your immune system and whether it's working that counts. Because as we get older, it doesn't work very well. As we're very young, first year or two of life, we're vulnerable because we're actually, through breast milk, getting mother's immune factors, and that tells us something about women ought to be breastfeeding more. Because formula will not have the immune factors. But so the baby leans on mommy's, of course, immune factors. But what we're getting here is the story that you really need to have a compromised immune system for this thing to get at you. This is why it comes, of course, from Asia every year, because it starts there where, of course, nutrition is poor, immunity is down, those kind of things. So this is the kind of thing we get. What they're going to try and do now is order up about 1 billion flu shots a year, get all the public softened up for the very idea of lining up for flu shots, and then, of course, now that we're all game for it, frighten us as they do every year the last few years to try to get us to line up and pay a few bucks and make the pharmaceutical companies widen their market. Understand, the marketing is being done by their shills. certainly the health authorities. And in this case, what we have are, you know, the United States runs the whole show because the Centers for Disease Control, even if you go to their website, they're doing studies and other things in other countries and all these other things. So this is kind of what you get. They're kind of the, what sets the pace is our country. And so this is the kind of thing that we've gotten ourselves into. And, of course, it's a frightening thing, and as I wrote on the website, on my blog this morning, I was talking about, of course, the radio broadcast of 1938, The War of the Worlds, Orson Welles, and how he had his radio theater of the air, and then went on and told that he was going to have a little departure from his normal broadcast, and then went into his radio theater of the air. They were having a play on the air, the various actors acting the parts. And then, of course, all of a sudden there was an interruption. And a newscaster came on and said, "We interrupt this broadcast." And then they took people out into the field where a field reporter then declared that the Martians had landed in a field in New Jersey, that some of these creatures were getting out of the spacecraft and the flying saucer and so on. And this kept on. They went back to the theater, then they kept back to the news report. And sooner or later, people got the idea this was real. This was real. And, of course, this is just the way it went on. And it kept building and building. And, of course, as they explained it, people eventually thought it was so real, they packed the roads in their cars, they hid in cellars, loaded guns, wrapped their heads in wet towels as protection from Martian poison gas, attempting to defend themselves against the aliens that were coming. I mean, this was the kind of thing that went on. And I think the politicians learned right there, the imagination carried this further than the reality.
But, you know, I think, Bill, it's so important that people understand that later on it turned out that this was part of an experiment on the American people to find out how they would react. And this was carefully calculated. They knew exactly what they were doing. It wasn't just simply, you know, entertainment. They were experimenting at that time to see how gullible the people would really be. And I think we're seeing exactly the same thing today. With this influenza, which is going to attack any time. It's not a matter of if, but it's a matter simply of when. And you say that often enough, and you come up with a 50% mortality figure, and you never mention, you know, that you've got a great deal more chance of getting hit by lightning than you have of getting the bird flu, and you repeat it over and over again, 100 people are dead, but they're all overseas. There's not one case in America. It's amazing. It's like, you know, the War of the Worlds all over again. And the average individual has no idea that that program back in 1938 was calculated, it was planned, it was an experiment. How gullible are the American people? And I think they learned.
Well, then we come to our modern era, and it's University of California have people called demographers. They go back and look at demography, that is, things that have to do, of course, around the globe, and like diseases, and, of course, we're going to tell you, in a moment now, after the break, just exactly what they had to say about the flu outbreak of 1918.
Now, we're going to be back here in just a moment with our good friend Bill Sardi. We're talking about the avian influenza. And believe me, there are a lot of good people who've been swept up in this whole hysteria. People I like and people I admire, but they're playing games with our minds, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, you should be prepared. I think that there are going to be some terrible catastrophes in America. But I will tell you that if we do have an influenza outbreak of this magnitude, it will not be because of a mutation that occurred simply out in the field. I believe it'll be a mutation that occurred in a laboratory someplace. All right, Bill, go ahead.
Well, certainly as we look at the story, the University of California demographers were looking at who died in 1918. Now, this was an interesting era because it was an era before antibiotics. Our troops, our young men, had gone off to war and come back. And, of course, World War I was over, but they brought back with them tuberculosis. And it was a lung infection. Now, it's a bacterium. It's not a virus. You cough and you have it in your lungs. And they were wondering why so many people that had tuberculosis died after 1918. The TB rate dropped considerably, almost to zero. And what happened is that they matched it up with the fact that the flu virus of 1918 was odd. It didn't kill the very young and the very old as other flu outbreaks. It killed 25 to 34-year-olds. And, of course, these were the young men who went off to war, came back, infected their families. They had tuberculosis in their lungs. They were coughing already. And then came the influenza virus. You see how important it is to have a good immune system here? Here's another vulnerable group. And then, of course, they succumbed. Their lungs literally filled with fluid in hours, and they expired. And, of course, what this is telling us is the demographers at the University of California, Berkeley, say, in their own words, this kind of flu epidemic may never be seen again in future pandemics. And it's because of the large group that had tuberculosis. Now, today we have antibiotics. TB only comes in primarily from immigrants that come here. But to go back the other way, on the planet there are 2 billion people who have tuberculosis of the lung. And, of course, 2 billion out of 6 billion people on the planet. Who's the most vulnerable? I think they are. And if they ever do get a flu bug encircling the globe that is very virulent, then you've got 2 billion people, and we begin to wonder about, well, the World Health Organization is responsible for both health and life and keeping people alive and healthy, and at the same time, they have another dark side in that they are attempting to limit the population growth in the world. And, of course, we know that they've been up to nefarious activities in the past, and, of course, now we begin to wonder. They have created a flu virus that's 29,000, 39,000 times stronger than any virulent flu virus whatsoever that came from nature. This was created by mutating the virus many times, created at the University of Wisconsin. It's in a laboratory there, by the way, not the highest security lab, surprisingly. They actually take vials of it and ship it around the world to laboratories who want to test it. So it's in little boxes that UPS is shipping. There's no markings on it. I don't know what happens. But anyway, that is getting shipped around. If this should ever escape, and they should ever have a worker come home in Wisconsin and spread it to someone else, well, God help humanity, because especially if your immune system is down. Now, so many people don't realize the list gets bigger, because these are people on immune-suppressing drugs. They're diabetics. They're people with autoimmune diseases like lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. We have to watch carefully, certainly, about the pregnant females at any time. We have the very young children.
Well, that's out there. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Go right ahead, Bill.
Well, certainly the story of the flu is really got a lot of holes in it. Why does the news media keep parroting every press release that comes out? And that's what we have to ask. And it's all over the world. They're controlling the news media. And, of course, what we're trying to tell you is that, of course, it's hard for us to believe the news media is in on this thing. But either they've got some awfully dumb reporters, or they're just working on command here of some kind. This makes no sense whatsoever. In this past week or so, we saw a story in the news media about raloxifene. It's a drug being given to women in post-menopause. And, of course, they were told this past week that they could take it for breast cancer because it works equally well as tamoxifen, the anti-breast cancer drug, but far fewer side effects. How few? How? Well, you need another 440 women to take raloxifene, and then one more woman will have one less side effect, you see. But this was supposedly a giant breakthrough. The drug's made by Eli Lilly. the Bush family senior is on the board of directors of Eli Lilly. Was this a favor to them? Well, we don't know, but when the government sent out its press release, virtually every reporter in the United States sent out a mirror copy of it. Just changed the words around, and there it was. Women, you need no longer fear tamoxifen. You can take raloxifene. Now, if you have one extra woman out of 440 that escapes a side effect, that, let me see, one out of 100 is 1%, one out of 440, why, that's about one-fifth of 1%. Would you call that statistically significant, Dr. Stan? I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
No. So this is the kind of headlines we're being told. It's just hard for us to understand that the New York Times and every other news service is in on this, well, misdirection to women who have breast cancer. And, of course, it goes on and on, whether it's the flu or whatever it is. We see that so many things in medicine today, there's some sort of relationship where the politicians and government is in league, with the manufacturers of these vaccines or medicines, and then, of course, the news media carries the story without question. And, of course, this is just the way it goes. And so if you look at the story on the flu, and you're going to read the outbreaks were in 1918, 1957, and 1968, and they try and tell you because there's a flu cycle. What cycle? Let's see, the gap between 1918 and 58, that would have been about 40 years, then from 58 to 68, that's 10 years. Then there was another one, 1978. Well, they call that an outbreak, but only 8,300 people die. It was mostly young people. I don't know how they call that an outbreak. The other ones were quite much bigger numbers. Because they say every year 36,000 people die, and then he declared the one in 1977 an epidemic when only 8,000 people died. I mean, this is such craziness, nothing making any sense, because they're trying to show that there's a cycle to it every 10 years, so they come up with the one that was a low year and still call it an epidemic. But the year where 93,000 more people died, they overlook it because it's in the wrong year for the cycle to have occurred. See, you see, they're not telling us. Where are the health reporters here? These guys are certainly well-trained. They could look this kind of thing up, so they're just looking the other way. This makes no sense to me at all. And, of course, we know that the public hears 36,000 Americans die. One, that would be the very vulnerable elderly and so on. Number two is they take the deaths from pneumonia and match it up and combine it with influenza. So a lot of older folks do die of pneumonia, so we don't, because they match those two numbers together, we can't really tell how much of it was really the flu. Now, we do think a few people do die every year, but it's certainly not 36,000. It might be far less than 15,000. And, of course, the hype is to scare us every year into thinking there's death. If you're a 25- or 30-year-old adult, you're not going to die of the flu. You may get the flu. It's what your immune system's doing. Now, for the older folks, they do need to take vitamin E, boost their immune system, and even help the vaccines work better. And, of course, we have a lot of other natural medicines that work, too.
All right, John. How about vitamin D? Doesn't that have a specific effect?
Well, absolutely. Vitamin D, we find that the flu comes in winter when vitamin D levels are down. And, of course, this keeps us from getting, it normalizes the immune system so our lungs won't fill with fluid and we die. We might get the flu, but we won't die of the flu.
And, of course, this is one of the things that is being poo-pooed by the medical establishment, by the Wall Street Journal. I wonder why the Wall Street Journal keeps running these ads saying there's just no benefit from vitamins. We're sure you can trust us. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Bill Sardi. Bill, go ahead, pick the story up.
Well, certainly as we look at this flu story, and we're trying to give you these by example so you can catch wind of a bigger story even, and that is that the government issues health bulletins. Maybe we need to be more skeptical of those. Here's, Here's even MSNBC saying skeptics warn that the bird flu fears are overblown and going on into quoting some people and saying this. But of course it's overshadowed because we don't know when they're crying wolf. And so all of us, even though we know what they're doing, we're not quite so sure and we're a little concerned in the back of our mind. Well, what were we supposed to do? They're not going to have enough vaccine. The vaccines don't work. If the vaccines were available, do you think you could get there in the panic that will ensue? Don't you think they're going to close off the roads and all these kind of things anyway? They're going to have the quarantines. And if you can you see Americans getting turned against American because going down to the store or going to school, you know, they're all, you didn't get your shot. So now all of a sudden we're going to be ostracized if we don't get the shots ourselves, and of course then expose ourselves. If they're building these new vaccines, they're untried, and of course what if they made a mistake in those vaccines? They're untried. Maybe there's a contaminant in there as there was in the polio vaccine. And then we've really got a bigger problem. And of course this goes on and on. Will they vaccinate the entire military? What will they do? And of course, they seem to be plotting and planning for something on a world scale, and this seems to be some sort of an exercise for drill to try and get more than a billion flu vaccine shots sold every year instead of 100 million that they just sell in the United States every year. So everybody attuned to this. The risk is coming. They beat the drum. They blow the horn. And then all of us in fear line up and pay a few dollars to have the shots. And of course, now it might be a shot against the bird flu, of which humans don't get. It has to be some sort of a major mutated form, and we're many mutations away from that ever occurring. And of course, what does it all mean? Why would I get a shot for the H5N1 when it's a bird flu? Well, you see, maybe they figure if they just inoculate us against something innocent, we'll all just get a worthless shot and they'll all make the money. I mean, I don't know what their thinking is, but I have to do a little exploring with the audience here to help them see their way through this because they can't.
Hold that thought right there, Bill. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty and our guest this evening, Bill Sardi. And Bill, I wanted to you go ahead and get your website out there so people will know how to get your website and pull down your information.
Well, of course, we're breaking this story, and of course, you'll get more information here than you will find in any other news source. What they're not telling you about the predicted flu epidemic, it's at knowledgeofhealth.com. Lots of free reports there and things. And there are a few of my books for sale there. I make no profit on them, but if you're a book reader and you want to have good health, I find the profits all go to managing the website and the people that keep it up on the Internet. But it's all there for you. There's information about autism and blood pressure and arthritis and so on and what to do in menopause. So you might want to check out a lot of that information. Some people like to get to me on the Internet, ask questions. And, of course, we answer all questions, no charges. Try to do that as a public service. We're trying to give you good information tonight. We thank Radio Liberty for giving us the airtime to share with you and, of course, give you this information. We work hard to dig up good facts and try to, you know, give you the information the way it should be given to you. And these health subjects get rather confusing, especially when we read things that are in the contrary in the newspapers, hear it on television, and so on, and then we wonder about certain things. So, you know, it really takes a lot of study and digging into these things and sorting them out and making sure that we're right when we do it. We list all the references that we researched in all of our articles. We don't pretend to be experts. We pretend to be good reporters. And, of course, this is what we're trying to give to you is good information. Many of you may be concerned about the drug Tamiflu. There's a connection there, of course, with Donald Rumsfeld. Secretary of Defense did captain a pharmaceutical company at one time, Gilead Pharmaceuticals, and of course they make the, today they still have stock in that company, and they make the Tamiflu, and of course Tamiflu is only helpful at the beginning of the, when you get the symptoms of the flu, and then it's never been proven to lower mortality rates, and of course it does have some side effects, and it's killed a few children in Japan where they use it more widely there, and it's something that I doubt will be much of an effect in helping. It does shorten the symptoms by a day or a day and a half. That isn't the issue. What we need to do is show that we can calm and normalize the immune system so it doesn't overreact, fill our lungs with fluid, and cause us to die of a pneumonia-like flu reaction. That's what we need to do, is calm that down. Now, we do know that there are not only vitamin D, but we have selenium. It's a trace mineral. It's in the soil. Some of us live in areas where the soil levels are low, so the foods we eat are likely to be low in selenium. And selenium, it keeps the gene mutation from occurring, so that if you get the flu, it doesn't mutate into the form that can be virulent and mortal. So, again, all of this being very well documented in the media, in the medical journals, but not shared with the public. I had a microbiologist get a hold of me on the internet and try to tell me I didn't know what I was talking about. Of course, by 6 or 7 emails later, he was thanking me for all the information he had never been aware of before. So, you know, it's a little startling, and we try and use good science with good references and try and get it out to the public. And even our microbiologists and virologists aren't caught up with all this information as they should be. According to Reuters News, as of this month, 110 people have died of the H5N1 bird flu virus. Out of 196 that are infected, and of course all of them virtually poultry workers. So this is after, by the way, a number of years, and as we say, the bird flu has been in the birds, in the flock, since 1959. So nobody was worried about it in 1965, 1975, 1995, doesn't matter. So why now? Why are we so worried about this? There's a different strain of the flu, H3N2, which has killed over 500,000 Americans. And you never hear about that one. So it's all in our report. We try and give it to you. The lessons learned here, if you're in a high-risk group, if you're an older adult or you're very young, you have very young children at home, you need to take special precautions. You go to my website. You can read about this. Some of it's in our report. We tell you about things that may sound a little silly, like elderberry syrup, vitamin E, selenium, certainly vitamin C. All of these are very good for our immune system. They help us, of course, build our immunity, and we just need to know, well, how much, where do we get it, what is involved, is there good science behind it. Fresh crushed garlic is always good to have around. It works quite well. So, and it goes on like this. There are good things that you can use. In Israel, they're studying elderberry syrup. There's now, I think, 4 or 5 reports on its use with the flu, and it's strikingly good results in helping adults and children when they get the flu. So, of course, all of these things are just things to learn, and we need to know how to use them, put them in our home medicine chest. Understand there isn't a good antiviral drug, and the vaccines don't work so well, and of course that's why we're going to some of these natural remedies. The Centers for Disease Control, the FDA, don't want you to learn about them, because then you won't go get the vaccines. They're vaccine sales organizations. So this is what you're facing. You're facing a organizations in government that may not be working in your best interest, but working in the interest of selling vaccines. They may be ineffective, they may be inaccessible for a lot of people, but they want to tell you that's the only defense we have. It's really odd that we never have a backup plan, even though we don't have enough vaccine for everyone in the country. Isn't that odd? Somebody's remiss here, and if there really is a flu that could kill us all, well then, they're just leaving most of the population at risk here, because they never make more than 100 million doses of the vaccine, when we have, I think, about 287 million Americans now. So this is our problem. We're trying to spell it all out for you in ways that you can see with good references so you can understand the real story about the flu and why the story the news media won't let go of it, why it stays in the news. We're being softened up. If this isn't propaganda, I don't know. You'll never understand it if you can't see it here. And, of course, you just need to be able to sort this out for yourself. That's why we try and give it to you so you can look at it in print with your own eyes and examine what we're saying here verbally. Because we have a lot of license here without any feedback from the listening audience to just talk and give you information. So the first time you hear it, you're not exactly sure you buy it all. Well, we give you a chance to read it, check the resources, ask me questions, go to the internet, knowledgeofhealth.com. Let's see, let's pinch ourselves and see if any of this is really true. By the way, last week we had another groundbreaking report on our website because as we started this story tonight, we were talking about the decline in the death rate. Last week they reported, National Center for Health Statistics, that there was a drop in the death rate, a significant one last year, and it got about 50,000 less deaths, and most of it from cardiovascular death. And we began to scratch our head and wondered, and we were the first ones to report, and we wondered if this wasn't because they took Vioxx off the marketplace. Remember Vioxx, the anti-inflammatory drug that was causing the blood clots, and therefore that was a cardiovascular, you'd get a heart attack? And it was Dr. David Graham at the Food and Drug Administration who reported that Vioxx would cause about that many deaths, between 30 and 70,000 or so Americans might die. And sure enough, here's the dramatic drop in the death rate. And, of course, it when Vioxx came on the market, there was a slight rise in the death rate. Now, it was only slight, but there weren't as many people taking Vioxx as there were 4 or 5 years later when the recall came about. And then this death rate, of course, dropped. There were about 19 million prescriptions for Vioxx, and then it dropped to about 13 million. So it was a drop of about 6 million prescriptions. And this is where we saw the 50,000 less deaths in the American population than the previous year. The death rate dropped. Well, we think it's because they took Vioxx off the marketplace. Again, you won't hear these stories elsewhere, and that's why we encourage you to use our website as a good source of health information at knowledgeofhealth.com.
Well, I think that people have to really realize that they knew that Vioxx was going to kill people, and they did absolutely nothing about it. We have a newsletter up on my website going into Dr. Graham's testimony. We reproduced his entire testimony, gave you what the government knew ahead of time, and they allowed this to be put on the market, knowing that it would increase, you know, the incidence of heart disease, heart attack, and stroke 6 or 7-fold. Now, they will tell you, of course, you know, this is a wonderful drug. You know, it's going to decrease your chance of dying of high blood pressure 3%. I mean, here's a drug that increases the incidence of heart attack and stroke 6 or 7 times. We're talking about Vioxx, and they allow that on the market. And, you know, this is the great tragedy. In fact, it would still be on the market if it hadn't been for Dr. David Graham risking his career and going before the Senate to let the American people know the truth. And then, of course, the FDA, went along with taking it off the market. But they were totally unconcerned about the amount of harm that they did. And Bill did allude, of course, to the fact that, one of the vaccines, the polio vaccine had a cancer-producing virus, SV4. We carry a book called The Virus and the Vaccine that goes into the fact that there's so many cancers today, and if they're tested, they will carry this cancer-producing virus. Well, this was actually in the original polio vaccine, and they lied to the American people, and rather than let them know it was happening, they allowed two of the vaccine producers to actually continue to use up all their stocks until it was gone. Now, I will say that at that time, back in 1960, Merck did pull their polio vaccine, oral polio vaccine, off the market, but the FDA let the other companies continue disseminating that cancer, that vaccine that they knew had a cancer-producing virus in it. And to this very day, they're lying to the American people about it, because after all, if the American people realize that, they wouldn't trust the government.
Well, certainly we see this all the way along. If the public loses the confidence in the vaccine system, and shame on the American Academy of Pediatrics for letting this autism problem get out of hand. We know it's related to the vaccinations. Even the parents can see it within hours of the vaccine being administered. And, of course, the doctors are all saying, no, no, the studies show otherwise. With no other probable cause, and, of course, what is it, one out of every 130 children in California or something now have autism. I mean, it's terrible, and yet they're not even searching for a cause. They're just saying they're going to improve the care after the children come down with autism. So they know what it is. It's the vaccines. Why would they not search frantically for what the other cause might be? They say that there's no evidence that the vaccines and the mercury and so on cause the autism, and then they make no pursuit of any other possible cause whatsoever. There's no funding for any other research in any other direction. So we know what this is. They're just covering. Of course, you can't even get pediatricians today to take care of your children unless you have all these shots. Now, I have a 22-month-old little boy here at home, and in 22 months, he was supposed to have gotten 26 different injections, 26 different shots in his regimen by now. You know, this is just too much. And by the way, this is a child under 2, and they would have been in, shooting him up even before he was 6 months old. Now, a lot of the inserts on the packages for these vaccines say don't even give it to the child before 6 months. The pediatrician isn't even following these guidelines. But, you know, this is just great marketing. Just mandate it. Make the pediatricians lean on all the families to have it. And it's by law. You can't get your kids in school. You can't get them in college. You can't get them in nursing facilities. You can't get your kids in hospitals. You can't get your kids into nursery schools. It doesn't matter what it is. They're all requiring a shot record. And, of course, so many of us are capitulating. We have no gumption to stand up to the doctors whatsoever. It doesn't matter whether the doctor's giving us a liver-toxic drug like Crestor or one of the other statin drugs for cholesterol. I've had so many people just tell me, well, I don't want to lose my doctor. Well, I just can't stand up to him. Well, he's told me he's going to leave me as the doctor if I don't do... You see, these kinds of... Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have to take a step back. We just have to stop being little pawns on the chessboard. You know, we're paying a terrible price here. And, of course, it doesn't matter what it is. Now, on my website, I do have a free ebook, The Collapse of Conventional Medicine, trying to tell you all these things, whether it was estrogen replacement therapy for women, which was being prescribed for years and then turned out that wasn't so healthy for the women, whether it was arthroscopic knee surgery, they'd go in, take a look, pull the scope out, and bill Medicare or whoever for it, and, you know, it was overdone. Certainly mastectomies for women. They did these total breast removal surgeries, and then they found out that they weren't any more effective than the of course, the lumpectomies and so on. And then, of course, they even did the bone marrow transplants for the women with breast cancer. And of course, they were totally ineffective, but they'd get the women to lobby and appear on the front page of newspapers and I'm dying and I need this treatment, so the insurance companies would fold and pay for it. And this went on and on, knowing full well that it was totally ineffective. And this goes on and on. Medicine, conventional medicine, is collapsing around us. It's only us, being gullible, who keep lining up for all these medications, which, by the way, are unsafe. It was Ralph Nader's organization, Public Citizen, that's pointed out that most of the medicines on the market today are unsafe and have never undergone a safety study. To actually put these products on the market, they are proven to be effective, but not totally safe. And the safety study comes after you're using them. And then if you die, well, that will show up as the statistic. So this is kind of what we're facing today. And if you're on the 7 medications your doctor prescribed, you're over-medicated. That's simple.
Now, we're going to be back in just a moment here with Bill Soddy and wrap up this evening's program. Bill, once again, the website where people can get in touch with you.
Yeah, Knowledge of Health, knowledgeofhealth.com. Go to Radio Liberty first, of course. We recommend you always visit Radio Liberty.
Okay, hang on. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, Bill, we got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Certainly, I think it is puzzling and perplexing. We're trying to give you bigger examples than the smaller stories. And, of course, the smaller story, even though it seems to be big, is about the flu. The smaller story is, what do we do about it? But the bigger story is, why are they keeping to hyping this? Why do they continue to spread fear? Why is the news media in on this? What are the public agencies and government? What are they about? And of course, is there a population control agenda here? I mean, these are questions we ask. We don't want to be totally just conspiracy in every closet, but we have the right to ask questions, and I think the public needs to hear those questions and answer them for themselves. We need to try and give you as much good information so we're not just jumping to conclusions and putting ideas in your head. You need to come and examine some of these things for yourself. But, of course, for all of us, we're busy in our lives. We don't have the time to research all these things. So what we're trying to do is play a role of investigating, digging deep into some of these subjects and helping them sort them out. But please, don't just confine yourself to these smaller issues and see the bigger issue is, can we trust these government health agencies to give us good information? Are there other agendas in play, like population control and so on? And what are we going to do if any of these things occur? If we can't trust the medicines, where do we go? Alternative medicine is a grab bag. It's a bunch of New Age medicine. A lot of it is unproven. And so rather than go there, we try and give you alternatives that are proven in good science right in the medical literature, and try and give you some alternatives here so that you can find things that are less expensive and you can, of course, get healthy at home.
And, of course, there are things like vitamin C and vitamin D and
right.
selenium and certainly many of the other things, quercetin. Certainly the garlic has a very definite, certainly antibiotic effect, as do certain... all of these things are so important for health.
Well, they certainly are. We just need to learn the lessons. But will we play with fire in one hand and the natural medicines in the other, or are we going to learn enough about this and feel confident of it, you see, because we are playing with fire and we're so many people taking these troublesome medications and then the natural medicines to counter the side effects of them. So I'm hoping that more and more people, I keep hearing from people in your audience that they've given up all their medications. They feel better than they ever have, and of course, a lot of them on blood pressure.
Hold that right there, please. Well, Bill, I certainly appreciate you so much for being with us this evening. Do you have a parting thought before I let you go?
Well, don't worry about the bird flu. It's for the birds, and the bird flocks aren't even dying. So I think it's a yawner of a story. I do think you should keep your eye on it just to see what government's up to. I think they're up to a bigger and a more nefarious objective, but nonetheless, I really wouldn't worry about the bird flu. If you're worried about the flu and the colds that come in the winter months, well, then certainly learn about some of these natural remedies.
God bless. Thanks so much, Bill.
Good night.
Bye-bye. Okay, that was Bill Soddy. Hope you enjoyed our program with Bill. And this is the time, of course, let me just mention that we actually have a couple of wonderful books that will give you the background of things that you need to know about your health. One of them is Russell Blaylock's excellent book, Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. That's Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. We carry a new book. It's called Children's Health. We have a book on magnesium. We have a book on the statin drugs. We have a wonderful four-tape set on life-saving health secrets. If you want to know the truth about autism, we have a four-tape set on autism. If you want to know the truth about mercury, why, of course, we have two four-tape sets on mercury. The government recently came out with a report and said, we can assure you that if you have your children's teeth filled with mercury fillings, they call them silver fillings, there's absolutely nothing to worry about. We have two studies, each with 500 children, one in Portugal, one in New England, and there is no harm at all. And then if you read the full story, and believe me, I read the New York Times, and they sort of take out the important point, that the children initially had elevated blood levels of mercury, and then eventually they went to normal. Well, of course they're going to go to normal, but you don't determine the problem with the blood levels. It's the children who can't excrete the mercury that put it into their brains. Well, they said, over three or four, I guess it was 5 or 6 years, well, they didn't notice any metal deficiency, but they didn't check into the children for autism because it was too small a number to already to be concerned about autism. But we can assure you, trust us. I mean, it's perfectly safe for us to put mercury in your teeth to elevate the blood level initially. Of course, if you're a pregnant woman, don't you dare even think about eating fish with mercury in it, but roll up your sleeve if you're pregnant, and we're going to go ahead and give you a mercury-laden influenza shot because we've left it in the influenza vaccines. Why would you do something like that? If you doubt many of the things we're saying, we'll be glad to send you a page from Dr. Fudenberg's website. Dr. Fudenberg's in his 80s, the dean of vaccinologist, pointing out that if you are foolish enough to take an influenza shot, say three or four of them over a five-year period, you're between 60 and 65, 10 years later, your incidence of Alzheimer's disease is up 1,000%. They know that. They just don't want you to know. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Our website is radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. The books we recommend, Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life, Children's Health, and we have so much more. I think our new book on statins, our four-tape set on statins, our four-tape set on mercury, our four-tape set on aspartame and MSG, our four-tape set on fluorides, all of these things you need to get. You need to understand there is a population-controlled agenda. Please pray for Radio Liberty. Pray for revival. Pray for our country. And we're together again. May the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line from Southern California, Dr. Garth Nicholson. And Dr. Nicholson held a professorial position at the MB Anderson Clinic in Houston, Texas, and of course was on the editorials board of a number of scientific journals, and has in the neighborhood of about 600 peer-reviewed articles in the literature, which is quite unparalleled. Very, very few people have very many peer-reviewed articles. He's a prolific writer. He's certainly known throughout the scientific world for his work. But Chris, we're going to be talking to him today about his experiences as he began to delve into the Gulf War illness and the chronic fatigue syndrome and the experiments that were done on prisoners at the Huntsville prisons in Texas, and of course what happened to he and his wife as a result of their effort to help people who have these terrible, terrible diseases, these terrible disabling diseases. And of course, he's written a book which we carry called Project Daylily. Now, it's a faction book. It's written as fiction, but it's really based upon fact and the incredible experiences he and his wife had. Dr. Nicholson, thank you so very much for being with us this evening. Dr. Nicholson, are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right, fine. Well, thank you so very much for being with us as we begin to, of course, go into the background of the fascinating book you've written, Project Daylily. So, just for our listeners who may not know who you are, could you just give us a little rundown, perhaps fill in the blanks from what I said?
Well, I'm currently the President and Chief Scientific Officer of the Institute for Molecular Medicine here in California. And this is a nonprofit research institution dedicated to discovering new diagnostic and therapeutic protocols for treatment of chronic illnesses. And we deal with a lot of different types of chronic illnesses. We work with autoimmune illnesses, for example, fatiguing illnesses, like you mentioned, Gulf War illness, and chronic fatigue syndrome are two of the most common fatiguing illnesses, but there are others as well. We also work with rheumatic diseases, things like rheumatoid arthritis and sarcoidosis and other rheumatic diseases. We work on cardiopulmonary problems, such as asthma, also cases of atypical pneumonia. And we also are involved in cardiovascular problems, such as vasculitis, coronary problems, all sorts of problems associated, as it turns out, with infections.
All right, fine. Of course, you actually, of course, have been working with a lot of people with neurological diseases, because there really was a very, very high incidence of so-called Lou Gehrig's disease with the veterans of the Gulf War, weren't they?
Yes, there were several times higher incidence than expected of Lou Gehrig's disease, or ALS, Gulf War veterans. Also, multiple sclerosis and other neurologic illnesses as well.
So, of course, there's been a conscious effort to convince both physicians and the public that Gulf War illness was really nothing more than post-traumatic stress. But as you began looking into this, why, you found, of course, a great deal more. We'll cover that when we get back here in just a moment at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. Garth Nicholson. And could you go ahead and just give us a little bit of the background uh, of, certainly the background of the Gulf War illness for our listeners out there, and how this more or less overlaps this series of symptoms and signs of this physical illness, how this overlaps with chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia, which affects really about 2 million people are said to have had chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia, and then somewhere between about a third to a half of the veterans of the First Gulf War?
That's approximately a third of the veterans of the First Gulf War have come down with a variety of different problems. The most severe of those turn out to be illnesses that are essentially the same as chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia syndrome, except that they progress, and they can progress to a lethal form of the disease, which you don't often see in civilian cases of chronic fatigue syndrome, although it can happen and has happened. These people die of premature deaths with the neurologic problems or cardiovascular problems or other problems, and they don't just have chronic fatigue. And we found out early on with the veterans coming back from the First Gulf War, that's at the time period when the Pentagon and the VA was trying to tell everybody that it was a psychological problem, post-traumatic stress disorder, and none of the signs and symptoms fit with that, or let's say the certain signs and symptoms didn't fit with post-traumatic stress disorder at all. They were medical signs and symptoms, and we found that they were due to chronic infections. And one of the chronic infections that we found, which is the story Project Daylily, is an infection that actually had been worked on by the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology for several years. The experts turns out, all in the Army or worked for the Army. And Army pathologists at the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology had been working on this infection. It turns out this is what at least 40% of the Gulf War veterans who came down sick had, this particular infection.
Oh, and weren't they working on it as sort of a biological warfare agent?
Well, that's what we think, because it was being tested in the prison system under the guise of a vaccine development program that was sponsored by either pharmaceutical companies or directly by the Army. And various prisoners were coming down sick and dying, and the guards were getting sick. And we got involved because the guards and their family members came to us for assistance. As a matter of fact, just yesterday, one of these gals called us up on the telephone. Her husband was the assistant warden in the Walls Unit, which is a condemned prisoner unit in Huntsville, Texas, at one of the prisons.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. Garth Nicholson. And Dr. Nicholson was talking about this chronic fatigue type of illness that seems to be related to a mycoplasma infection. He was mentioning that just recently why the wife of one of the wardens there at the Huntsville Clinic had called him. Pick up the story there.
Well, what happened was that the entire family had become sick because of these infections that were being tested in the prison system. Had passed to the prison guards and the administrators and the healthcare workers at the prisons, and they took the infections home and they passed to their family members. And this one family was absolutely riddled with disease. In fact, the daughter was diagnosed with ALS at Baylor College of Medicine. But she didn't have real ALS or true ALS. She had an atypical form, which means that most of the diagnosis was presented as ALS, but there were some atypical aspects to it. And this really concerns the infection that she had. And when she found that she had this mycoplasma fermentans that we also found in the Gulf War veterans, she was placed on antibiotics as quickly as possible. And eventually she recovered, and she went on to have two healthy children and lead a normal, healthy life. And she was given a life expectancy of 2 years when we met her. So these people have all kinds of different problems. It turns out this family, the husband retired, they went to Kansas, and now they're living in Oklahoma, and they're all recovered and doing quite well now. And we've seen this over and over again, where people are denied proper care and treatment because to hide essentially the types of illnesses that they harbor. And in this particular case, we feel that they actually were exposed to a biologic weapon. And the reason for that is that when we started studying this one infection, this mycoplasma fermentans, which is one of the infections that we found in the Gulf War veterans in more detail, we found that there were some unusual genes associated with it. And one of the genes happened to be from the HIV virus, the envelope gene. And this told us that there was something very peculiar going on, because there's no reason why that particular gene would be associated with this bacterial infection. And then when we started studying this further, we found out that, well, one of the things that this infection does is it invades cells very quickly, and that may be the reason why this particular gene was inserted. But there were other genes as well, genes to improve the survivability of the organism, to make it more heat-resistant, and so on. And all these smack of weaponization. They just smack of modifying an existing pathogenic microorganism to make it more pathogenic and to make it more survivable out in the real world. And so it just, to us, it just smacked of a biologic weapon. And that's what we hypothesized was in play at this particular prison and in some of the veterans that came back from the first Gulf War. Now, unfortunately, in the second Gulf War, we also have veterans that are coming back, and the DoD is trying the same story all over again, that they're suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And I don't think that's the case. But epidemiological studies, both done in Kansas and done in the UK, support the notion that these infections are probably picked up in the vaccine. So you can see why they want to hide this fact from the American people, that these might be friendly fire casualties that we're seeing, not only from the first Gulf War, where there are over 150,000 that are sick, but also now from the second Gulf War, that soldiers are coming back, veterans are presenting with some of these unusual signs and symptoms. So we have the problem, history is repeating itself all over again, and that is unfortunate, because we thought that we'd put it behind us and that we'd buried our mistakes, but that doesn't seem to be the case.
Well, of course, the thing is that when you began to look into this, that's when your whole life began to unravel. In other words, when you were simply, working there at the MB Anderson Clinic and doing your research, that was all well and good. But when you began looking into this possibility of a biological warfare agent, which of course is in violation of the various treaties that we passed, that have been signed and supposedly the law of our land, when you began looking into that, why then? Then, of course, you came under tremendous pressure. Would you like to get into that? Because that really is the subject of your book, Project Alien. What happens to a scientist, when he begins to try to get to the bottom of a disease that is afflicting literally millions of people in America?
Well, literally, my whole life was turned upside down, and that of my wife's as well. I mean, they literally destroyed my career in Texas, and I was an endowed full professor. I held a very prestigious position, the David Bruton Chair in Cancer Research. I was a professor and chairman of a large department and had approximately 100 people working for me. And they, that is, the administrators at the Texas Medical Center, went after me to the point where they hounded me so much that I just decided to leave because of the pressure and of the attempts on our lives. And this is covered really in the book. I had a superior of mine who was shot in the back of the head in his office. I've had two of my students that died under mysterious circumstances. It became a very unsafe place for us to work. And the book goes into that in detail and how we escaped many times. And so we decided that we were pressing our luck a little bit too much, that we needed to get out. And so we did. We left Texas and came to California, and we set up a nonprofit research institution to study these chronic illnesses that so many people are suffering from.
Well, now, the superior, the gentleman that was shot in the back of the head, wasn't he a retired officer, either Air Force or military, colonel or something? And he had told you within a few minutes before he was executed that he was going to come forward and talk about the things that you were delving into?
Yes, he was actually planning on blowing the whistle on the prison experiments because he didn't like it. He didn't believe in it. He thought it was wrong, and he thought it was totally unethical. They were also involved in some nursing home scandals where outside of San Antonio there were some rest homes or nursing homes which we hypothesize acquired basically to test some of these organisms. So I didn't even know it at the time that my own institution was involved in some of these horrific experiments. And so this is one reason why they went after me and went after my wife. And so it was a real horror story for us. And we turned it into a medical thriller, which is really what it is, and finding the answers for people. That's a success of the story, and escaping and telling the tale is the other aspect of it, which is kind of interesting to a lot of readers.
Well, I think it's important to have the book out there, because I think in some respects you're far better off to be a big target than a small target, and when people sort of forget about you, that's when your life is really in danger. It has happened to a number of the people that I've interviewed who have been very courageous and have, I believe, been killed for it. The last one was Gary Webb, who'd written a treatise on the CIA and drugs. He we're told he committed suicide by shooting himself in the head twice.
Well, we've run into a number of things like that as well, and quite frankly, it's a very common technique to get somebody and either get them into an accident where they lose their lives or get them to so-called commit suicide. And in fact, some of my colleagues in Houston were down as suicides, and they weren't suicidal. We knew that. We knew what happened. We knew that they'd stumble across things and were very vocal about it, and so they presented a threat, and they were eliminated because of that. So we didn't want to find ourselves in that situation.
And Chris, I think it's very difficult for the average American to believe that this could really happen in the United States. And where is the FBI? Where is our police agencies doing something about it? And I'm sure that we have many good police officers, but many times people in key positions are there for one and only one purpose, and that is to cover up and prevent an effective evaluation of what happened. Now, whatever happened to the gentleman? You said he was shot in the head, I think, twice. He was your superior. Wasn't he retired Army colonel or Air Force colonel?
Well, he was a retired Air Force colonel and a physician, and he was the vice president for patient care at the institution. And unfortunately, he knew a lot about the programs, the classified programs that were going on in the military. So he had a background already in the sort of thing that we were involved in. So he was very very kind to us, very supportive, and tried to help us whenever he could. I think what happened, he just overstepped the bounds, I guess, and it cost him his life.
And of course, but what about the investigation? You find somebody with two shots in the back of the head. Obviously this is a murder. What about the investigation of it?
Well, actually, he was shot six times in the back of the head.
Six times in the back of the head.
And back of the head and the shoulder in his office a few minutes after I had actually spoken to him early one morning. And the crime was never solved. And it was a professional hit because the person had gone in and escaped the institution and knew exactly where every security camera was located, and knew exactly how to get in and out of the building and not be seen by anyone.
Who would know how to hire a professional killer, other than people who were professional killers?
Well, we can speculate a lot. We think we know who did it. In fact, our hypothesis is actually presented in the book, and I won't tip my hat on that. I want people to get the book and read it, because it goes into a lot more information than what we've just described on how these programs started and so on. We actually looked into this in much more detail, and we found that the microbe that we discovered in the veterans was actually probably a microbe that came back in Operation Paperclip after World War II, when the Nazi scientists were being brought back to the United States after being rounded up by the CIA, or then was the OSS and the Army after World War II. So it actually has its origin in Eastern Europe. They were testing these weapons in the death camps to see how effective they were, and we grabbed a lot of these scientists after World War II and brought them back, and then tried to refine further these weapons because we knew the Russians were doing the same thing.
And of course, they were very, very effective weapons of killing human beings. They're biological weapons. We're not supposed to be experimenting with them. And yet, of course, as we'll probably mention later, there have been well over 100 biologists or microbiologists who've died under very mysterious circumstances in the last few years. Isn't that right?
Oh, yes. One of these, as a matter of fact, was coming to visit us, who'd replicated some of our results on the genetic modifications in the Mycoplasma fermentans, and he died under very suspicious circumstances on his way to our institution.
Well, the book is Project A. Lily. I've read it. I read the original draft of it, or one of the original drafts, and I'll tell you, it's a book that's difficult to put down. If you'd like to know more, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Dr. Garth Nicholson. We're talking about his book, Project A Lily, and I was just saying, I have read the book, and I'll tell you what, it is a real thriller. Of course, I understand what Dr. Nicholson's talking about. There's a lot of fascinating information there. It's written for the layperson, but a doctor can certainly get a great deal out of it. And, of course, it meant a lot more to me because I've had the opportunity of actually interviewing a number of people who are describing the book. Of course, their names are changed, or perhaps a few of the details are changed, but I certainly was very, very pleased to see them described. And these are heroic people, little people out there who have part of the puzzle. They're simply one dot on the chart, but you begin to collect these dots on the chart, and you begin to see truly a diabolical movement involving people in key positions in successive administrations and in science who are prostituting what they're doing, and they have applied their scientific knowledge and their brilliance not to helping people, but to learning how to destroy them more efficiently. What about the origin of the AIDS epidemic, and how does that play in here? You mentioned that these Mycoplasma fermentans that you found had a gene from the HIV virus. Now, how could a gene from HIV get onto a mycoplasma unless it was inserted there, you know, in the laboratory?
Well, that's exactly what we think happened, along with some of the other genes. But another interesting aspect of this is that HIV/AIDS itself is a very complex, multiple infectious process, and it's not just the HIV virus, as most people think. The HIV virus is actually not pathogenic, although it does suppress the immune system, and this can result in a number of opportunistic infections getting hold in a person with the HIV syndrome, and that's what really kills people. And one of the most common one is the Mycoplasma fermentans. And in fact, the Army's been studying this for years, been studying the mycoplasma as a cofactor in AIDS, and some people think it's the real pathogen in AIDS, and it really sets people up for the final events of AIDS, and then they get all kinds of opportunistic infections and then die.
And so basically it's a dual infection, HIV, and then this mycoplasma as well. And certainly they sort of work together. The HIV lowers the immune system, and then, of course, the mycoplasma can come in and actually invade the cells and kill them?
That's correct, and it does so in a very insidious way. And in fact, one of the pieces of the puzzle just came out. One of my colleagues in San Antonio just published a paper showing that toxins are released by the mycoplasma, and these toxins damage the cells in ways that we don't entirely understand. But he's been studying the respiratory effects, and he found that the toxin released by the mycoplasma really damages the respiration cells, the cells that line our lungs that were responsible for our breathing and so on. And these cells are literally killed by this toxic molecule, and so they have to be replaced. And if they're not replaced, then pulmonary damage, permanent pulmonary damage can occur. So there are also some other things that we know are released from these little mycoplasmas when they get inside our cells. And these we've been studying in a little bit more detail. They're called activated oxygen species. And what that means is that they damage cellular structures by oxidizing them. And they damage our DNA, for example. And one of the critical structures in our cells...
Would you hold that thought for just a minute as we bring our other stations right back on board? Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, Dr. Garth Nicholson. And he's certainly talking about how the mycoplasm works and actually destroys the cell, and certainly at least certain parts of the cell releases toxins. I can severely damage the cells of the lung. But you were going to be, I think, probably mention what they do to the mitochondria. This is the mycoplasm, which is associated with HIV. In other words, AIDS is not simply HIV infection, contrary to what most doctors and most people think. It is a combined infection. There's HIV, and most of the people have a mycoplasma. What percentage of people have the mycoplasma, do you think?
Well, it's at least 80%, according to the studies done by the Army, and it may even be higher because these infections are actually hard to detect. It can be detected, but it's really quite difficult because they hide inside our cells, And most tests are done with blood samples, and very little of these microbes get loose in the blood so we can detect them.
All right, now what about, you were going to say that, I think you're going to talk about the mycoplasm, was it hitting the, or attacking the mitochondria?
It does. The mitochondria are the little batteries inside our cells that provide the energy for all of our cellular functions. And there's some tissues, such as the tissues of the central nervous system, that require a lot of energy to operate. So, in fact, some of the nerve cells burn six times as much energy as other cells in the body. So they require these mitochondria inside the cells to be very active and produce a lot of high-energy substrates that the cell can use. And what happens is that the membrane of the mitochondria gets damaged by oxidation, by these molecules released from the mycoplasma, and it becomes leaky. And when it becomes leaky, it's just like stripping the insulation off a battery and then trying to put it in your flashlight. It won't work anymore because it's run down. The energy is escaped from the battery, and the same thing happens with our mitochondria. The potential across the membrane, the chemical potential, can't be maintained. And so that it's just like shorting out your battery, and they can no longer produce the high-energy molecules. And so this is what we found out happens, although we found some products that can reverse that and help patients with chronic fatigue quite a bit.
Now, you'd mentioned before something called Propax. Is there any? How can people get that? And, of course, are there any other products? What about CoQ10, for instance?
Well, there are a lot of lipid products and cofactors of lipid metabolism and so on that help. We've just gone directly to products that replace the damaged lipids entirely. And so these are all dietary products like Propex or NT Factor. And people can find out about these by going on our website, the Institute for Molecular Medicine, which is www.immed.org. Just think of immediate.org, and you'll find your way to our site. They can also just do a Google search or a Yahoo search and find us right away. And if they look under various categories and look under fatigue and illnesses, for example, they'll find articles on how we've used these products to restore mitochondrial function and to help people with their fatigue. And we've done studies on people during aging, because you lose a lot of mitochondrial function just naturally during aging. We've done studies on people with chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia syndrome. We've more recently done some studies with Gulf War veterans, and now we're just initiating a study with U.S. Navy SEALs in Afghanistan that are operating in a high altitude. All these individuals have problems with their mitochondria. Either they're being stressed and their mitochondria run down because of that, or because they have infections and their mitochondria are being damaged. And so they need to repair the membranes of the mitochondria, and that's what this dietary product does. It supplies the undamaged, unoxidized lipids so they can be naturally replaced through our normal metabolism. And that's the neat thing about this product, because we're not talking about taking a drug which could have potential side effects. We're talking about taking something that's completely natural that your body needs anyway and ordinarily would get through food, except that normally lipids are oxidized during food. And this is mainly why food becomes rancid, because oxidation occurs and things like lipids and proteins are damaged, and they can't be used as easily as we think once they're damaged.
Now, how do you spell that? Propac, is that P-A-C-K or P-A-C?
No, oh, that's P-R-O-P-A-X.
Oh, P-R-O-P-A-X, okay.
Propax. And there's a website, actually, www.propax.com. People can go on that and see some of the scientific studies that I've just mentioned.
All right, and is it taken by mouth, though? Is it
yes.
In the form of pill or capsule?
No, it's a dietary supplement.
All right, fine. We're going to be back here in just a moment or two with Dr. Garth Nicholson. We're talking about so many of the veterans of the first Gulf War, approximately a third of them, came back with a Gulf War illness, and many of these, of course, have chronic mycoplasma infections. Of course, the government did everything they could to conceal this. Dr. Nicholson has testified a number of times before Congress and very prestigious organizations. He's traveled. He was a visiting professor in Kuwait for a time, where many people have a great deal of illness following the first Gulf War. We'll be right back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Dr. Garth Nicholson, for talking about, of course, what they have found as they began looking into these fatiguing illnesses, as they began looking into the Gulf War illness. And, of course, there are many other diseases out there where we have multiple infections in the human body. One of the more interesting things that's increasingly become apparent that so many people who have arterial disease and heart attacks have chronic infections as the basis for this. Oh, we think, oh, we just take enough statin drugs and get our cholesterol down, that's going to be fine. But half of the people who have heart attacks have a normal cholesterol. So then what part do these chronic infections play in heart attacks? And are some of our younger people dying as a result of these chronic infections?
Well, we do know that. In fact, when the Gulf War veterans came back, there was an unusual number of heart attacks among this generally young group, average age less than 25, and that was totally unexpected. And one of the reasons this happened was that they had infections like Mycoplasma fermentans, which can cause what's known as a vasculitis or an inflammation of the vascular system. And when this occurs, there are a lot of what are called pro-inflammatory molecules that are released into the circulation, and these increase the clotting rate. And so a little clots or thrombi form in the blood, and these lodge in the capillaries in a variety of different organs. And when this happens in the heart, it can cut off the blood flow to the heart and eventually lead to ischemic heart disease and a major heart attack. And this is exactly what happened with a lot of the veterans. We see a lot of people that have these infections that have abnormalities in blood clotting properties and the presence of these thrombi in their blood. And that's, again, due to the vasculitis or the invasion of the endothelial cells that line all of our blood circulation, all of the capillaries and all of the venules and so on and so forth in our body. So this can be a very dangerous situation if it gets out of control. And we've seen a lot of people, particularly elderly people, are very high risk, and also the very young. And the very young are very interesting. One of the things that we found from the Gulf War was that as these infections slowly spread to immediate family members, the adults were being diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia syndrome, but often the children had some very unusual learning disabilities and behavioral disabilities, and they were often getting diagnosed with autism or attention deficit disorder or some of the other autistic spectrum disorders. And at first we didn't really understand what was going on there, but we knew that these infections could penetrate into the central nervous system and cause problems. And in a developing brain, this is exactly what you don't want to have.
Hold that thought for just a moment, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Dr. Garth Nicholson. So we have a caller from Johnstown, New York. I'm going to ask him to hold on for just a couple of minutes because I want to develop this idea of what's happening to the children. Now, we know from many studies that have been done, certainly the Regal Committee report, Senator Regal investigated the Gulf War illness. He felt that about 70% of the wives of veterans were sick. The wife came down with the disease. According to the Rockefeller Committee report, which we actually carry as a report from the Veterans Administration, they said about 40% of the wives of ill veterans were ill. And now Dr. Nicholson is saying that many of the children of the ill veterans who came back from the first Gulf War, these children were reported with autism or learning disorders or things of that sort. So obviously this is a communicable disease, despite the fact that the CDC and the NIH and the Veterans Administration do not want the American people to know the truth. Would that be a fair statement?
I think that's a fair statement. There have been a lot of red herrings put out, particularly in these autistic spectrum disorders. And, of course, this is not the only factor that's involved. We know that there are other factors, for example, heavy metal exposure, chemical exposure, and so on. All of these illnesses that I've been discussing are usually quite complex and involve a number of different factors, not just the infection that we've been talking about. So it's one thing to fight the infection, but other things have to be done to these patients as well. If they have the heavy metal exposures, to remove them. If they have chemical exposures, they have to be treated in certain ways to remove those chemicals from their body and so on and so forth. So they're really quite complex diseases.
All right, fine. Well, let's go to our first guest, who is Daryl, who's calling from Johnstown, New York. Hi, Daryl. Did you have a question for our guest?
Yes, I did. It's to my knowledge, in our brains, we have chemicals called endorphins. And they are they aid the antibodies in, you know, curing certain diseases, you know, attacking certain germs in our body. And they are released, only to my knowledge, and I could be wrong, by emotions. And I wondered if there was any other stimulant towards endorphins that would get them to release to aid in helping cure certain problems.
Well, Chris,
I have another question.
Well, okay. What part do endorphins? Do endorphins play anything in part in what we're talking about, Dr.
Well, we really don't understand the role that they play, as well as any of the other neurotransmitter compounds that could be involved in these various neurologic illnesses. These are very complex relationships between the body and the mind, and when you have an infection involved, this kind of throws some of these systems out of order, and you do see some unusual things that come out of it.
Now, right, I think, Daryl, that endorphins really control pain, and this is the thing. Certain exercise will release endorphins. When you release the endorphins, they're almost like an opioid controlling the pain. Now, did you have another question for Dr. Nicholson?
No, just an experience that I had. You were talking about the military and how they don't want to, you know, release certain information. I'm a two-tour Vietnam combat veteran, and in 1967, when I went into the service, and I was on my way over to Vietnam, what we had to do, because of the lack of dentistry within the Army, and orthodontists and things like that, what they had us do was, you know, get in a group, and they gave us a very small toothbrush and a tube of toothpaste that was very high in fluoride and very abrasive. I believe they used a pumice. And we had to brush our teeth, you know, each tooth one at a time, with the substance, and I wondered if that, you know, destroyed a lot of our teeth by taking the enamel off the surface of our teeth.
Haven't they, Lisa? I have no thoughts on that at all. Do you, Dr. Nicholson?
I really don't either, because I really don't have enough information to really comment on that.
No, I think they're like...
Well, we all had to do it because there was a lack of dentistry within the service.
Okay, don't know anything about it, but thanks so much for calling. Let's go to Jeannie Soderman. Jeannie, did you have a question?
Well, Dr. Stan, I am on topic, and I did read Project Daylily, and Garth Nicholson, you're just a hero to me, writing this book, and it's a researcher, but on page 524, that's something very interesting that you wrote, and it was regarding the Nevada Trust, and I'm going to give you a website, because the Lear family of William P. Lear Sr., who invented the Lear jet, car radio, you name it, he was especially brilliant, it's called NevadaScams.com. And there is a lawsuit against the trustees, the attorneys, the district judges, and the Supreme Court judges of Nevada for stealing money from the Lear Trust. And so there again, the website is Nevada Scams, that's scams.com. And there's two generations of the Lears that are putting lawsuits on this, and it will go to the United States Supreme Court. And you might be interested in that, Dr. Nicholson.
And, of course, for our listeners out there who haven't read the book, of course, there's talk about a Nevada Trust, which, of course, belongs to Dr. Nicholson's wife. Anything else you wanted to say, Jeannie?
No, that's it. And thanks, Dr. Nicholson, for your courage and being such a great guy.
Bye-bye. Thanks, Jeannie.
Well, thanks very much. I mean, one of the aspects of the book is how do you finance all these programs and keep it secret? And one of the things that we stumbled across was the fact that trusts were being misused to support some of these programs, like the MK Ultra program, for example, the Manhattan 2 program, which was the development of a variety of different biologic agents and vaccines against them and so on.
And so these were actually Nevada trusts were paying, having to do with the gambling interest there in Las Vegas?
There were a number of different trusts. One was the Manhattan Trust. One was the Sterling Trust. One was the Sita Dharma Trust. All these were very large trusts that were supposed to be for humanitarian purposes, but they're being misused.
And, of course, there's a great deal of medical experimentation that is going on today. That is not for the betterment of mankind, I fear, but for the destruction of mankind. And that's a rather frightening concept, that scientists would actually engage in that sort of thing. But I'm sure that many times they are recruited into these programs. Would you have any comment on that? Because I've certainly looked at the information that's come out of these various reports of the Special Virus Cancer Project, which they were all supposed to be destroyed. The CIA project, all the records were going to be destroyed. They're not really very good. They didn't destroy them all, and we actually have some of those. I'm sure you've seen them as well. An awful lot of leading scientists were involved with the Central Intelligence Agency. Why would they do something like that?
Well, scientists are recruited all the time for various projects, and often they're given such a small piece, and they don't really understand the big picture, and they don't know how it fits in with other pieces, but they're offered contract money to pursue this line of research, and then they write up the reports and turn it back in, and often they never know what became of the research that they did, and often it's compiled and put together in some offices somewhere, in a covert way, and then that information is used. And so there are a number of different programs which have been going on. I mentioned the MK Ultra program, but there are all sorts of different classified programs that were going on where certain aspects of research they would contract out to certain people. There were over 120 universities in the United States that were involved in these kinds of projects, so this is not something that was done in a little corner laboratory. This was done in all the major pharmaceutical companies, all the major universities, and so on, were heavily engaged, and they were all reaping the economic benefits from these programs.
And yet, of course, an awful lot of the scientists ended up very, very dead. And in fact, the last one I remember, I had been found stabbed half a dozen times and stuffed in the trunk of his car when somebody set on fire. Why would anybody do that to a microbiologist? I mean, what could a microbiologist know that was so dangerous? And as you begin to read the book Project Daylily, I think that you'll begin to get a picture of why they would want to eliminate people and why Dr. Dickinson left his tenured position at MD Anderson Clinic. A fascinating adventure story. The only trouble is, certainly there's an awful lot of truth in this story. Well, what sort of response have you gotten from the scientists and others who've read the story?
Well, we've actually gotten a lot of good response. I haven't gotten any negative response yet, but then again, they probably wouldn't tell me directly about it. But we have a lot of good feedback. In fact, we have a website for the book, and people can actually read the comments from some of the leading scientists in the world. There's a Nobel laureate, for example, and several department chairmen that have made comments on the book. So that's projectdaylily.com. It's run together as one word.
All right, fine. That's projectdaylily.com. And we have another caller. Let's see who it is. Who is calling?
Lorna?
Hi, did you have a question for our guest?
Yes. As far as mercury exposure and that type of thing, I believe that my daughter, through her shots, had some problems because she had what they call lazy tongue syndrome and started stuttering.
Now, you're talking after vaccination shots?
Yes. And I was wondering what his suggestion would be as far as detoxing children.
All right, you're talking about detoxifying children. Now, did she have any contact with anybody with a Gulf War illness? Was this just a direct something that followed after her immunizations?
I think it was directly after her immunizations.
All right. Do you have any thoughts at all on that, Dr. Nicholson?
Well, we see the parallel between what happened, for example, in the Gulf War experience, where the multiple military vaccines were studied and shown by epidemiologists to be directly related to Gulf War illness after the Gulf War. And this is studies done in the U.S. as well as in Great Britain. Now we see the parallels in children who are undergoing developmental change at an early age, and they're given all these multiple vaccines, and there's an alarming rate of autism and autistic spectrum disorders in these children. And is there a relationship between those and the multiple vaccines? I think there is. But one of the ways in which this is being studied is that they choose a particular vaccine or group of vaccines, and then they study the relationship between that vaccine and illness. And that's not the way you do this type of study. You've got to take all of the vaccines and study them all at once, unfortunately, because it's probably the multiple vaccines. The vaccines themselves can be very immune suppressing, and either contaminants in the vaccine or opportunistic infections that are in the environment can get in these children and take hold, and then there are other exposures as well, either heavy metals, some of which are present in the vaccines, or some chemical exposures in the environment, and all of this can combine to give these developmental and learning disorders that we see in these children.
Well, one of the things that's always bothered me is that certainly we know in the original polio vaccine that they gave all of us, there were all the monkey viruses, and that was in the rhesus monkey. One of those, of course, was a cancer-producing virus, SV40, so then they switched over to the green monkey, and we got all of the viruses from them. And then sometimes we have, you know, the vaccines that are grown in chicken eggs or embryos, and then we get all the viruses. Are any of those viruses harmful to people, or do we have any way of knowing?
Well, there are studies, for example, that have followed, for example, you mentioned the SV40 virus, which is known to be a cancer-causing virus under certain conditions, so these viruses can contribute to pathogenic events. There's no doubt about it. And one of the other problems in the vaccines, one study that was done showed that 6% of them are contaminated, for example, with mycoplasma. So 6% doesn't sound like a large number, but when you vaccinating thousands and thousands of children, all of a sudden the numbers become very realistic.
Well, Lorna, do you have any suggestions at all as far as Lorna? What could she do, or what should she do as far as her daughter is concerned?
Well, you know, the thing that we tell people that have these problems is that, number one, you have to get to an expert that study these so that you know exactly what you're dealing with. That's the first thing. The second thing is, you've got to try and determine if they've been exposed to heavy metals, to chemicals, to some of these opportunistic infectious agents and so on. Once you have that information, then you can proceed on some kind of a treatment program for these children.
Well, I don't know that there's that many experts, and the cost involvement might be not possible for us right now to hire an expert in the
field. Well, this is a problem that we all face. And we have people coming to us all the time, and one of the first things that they tell us is that, you know, I'm broke. I've been to see 50 physicians. They can't figure out what's wrong with me. I've got this problem, that problem, whatever. And we try and help them. So if there are people out there that, you know, we'll try and help them. They can send an email, which is the best way to contact us, and we'll try and help them. We can't make referrals because we're a nonprofit institution, but we can point them in some general directions where they can get help.
How would it be the email address that people would send to?
Well, it's on our website for the Institute for Molecular Medicine, again, which is www.immed.org. Just remember, immedia.org. So they can look it up on Yahoo, for example. We do try and help people that have these problems.
And, of course, the first thing you have to do, Lorna, you have to make a diagnosis. You have to find out, I mean, really what the basis for it is. So why don't you send an address to Dr. Nicholson? Go ahead.
Okay, I also wanted to say, I don't know, have you ever heard of G.I. Guinea Pig, the book?
What's that?
It's called G.I. Guinea Pigs. It was a book about experiments and stuff they were doing on the World War II veterans.
Well, we've had misuse of military personnel ever since probably the Civil War for various medical experiments.
And
Guinea
Pig, my dad, it was really funny because he was in the Veterans Hospital in California, and all of a sudden somebody had the book, and he's like, well, wait a second, that's me. And he was in a picture. He was decontaminating somebody from radiation and nuclear exposure with a whisk broom, sweeping them down.
I will tell you, the tragedy is that they experiment on our men in the military. It's criminal activity, and yet those people have no comeback at all. This is well covered in the Rockefeller Committee report from the Veterans Administration, which we carry. They use our military as guinea pigs. That's why I will not advise any young person to go into the military, because you lose your rights, and if they destroy your life or kill you experimenting on you, you. Why, there's never any repercussions. It's one thing to be willing to die to protect your country. It's another thing to be used as a guinea pig without your consent or knowledge. Thank you so much for calling. Bye-bye.
You're welcome.
All right, fine. And so our guest this evening is Dr. Garth Nicholson. His book is entitled Project Daylily. It's available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. It's a fascinating adventure story. You know, in fact, you couldn't make up anything this incredible, and yet, of course, it is based upon the true story of Dr. Nicholson and his wife, who stumbled on a mass series of experiments we're carrying out on, of course, on prisoners at Huntsville and other prisons, and, of course, on our servicemen would appear in the Gulf War. And the great tragedy is, we're talking about several hundred thousand veterans of the first Gulf War are ill, and we know at least 25,000 of them have died. A very successful experiment. Well, Dr. Nicholson, we've got about 3 minutes to wrap up the program. What was your thought you'd like to leave with our listeners tonight?
Well, we've been talking about the book Project Daylily, and the more people know, I think the better armed they are to deal with these issues. The worst thing in the world that we could do is to hide our heads in the sand and pretend that these things don't exist and that our government is just a benign entity that is looking out for us, because often it's not. And some of the people in power are truly vicious and even evil. And we need to expose these people and get them out of government positions and get them out of laboratory positions where they can do harm to other individuals. And unfortunately, there is a program called eugenics that has been persuasive in the United States ever since the beginning of the last century. And this program exists and is still continued to this day. And there are people promoting this type of program to reduce world population and reduce the pressure, they think, on the United States of America by limiting the population of the world. But these issues and these ideas, I think, are absolutely foolhardy, because the methods that are being used, infectious agents, for example, cannot be controlled. You cannot control a microbe. You cannot control a microorganism. It will ultimately come back. And you would have thought that we'd learned this from Plum Island and Lyme disease, which originated in old Lyme, Connecticut, just across the bay from Plum Island off of Long Island. And once these diseases get out, then they spread, and Lyme disease is spread all across the United States and into Canada, and it will continue to spread. And by the way, one of the most important co-infections in Lyme disease is a mycoplasma. And in fact, that's one of the reasons I've been asked to speak at a number of Lyme disease conferences, because most people weren't aware of this. They were aware of some of the other co-infections in Lyme, like Ehrlichia and Babesia and Bartonella, but they weren't aware of the mycoplasma. And this is the most prominent co-infection in Lyme disease. So these types of diseases can lead to chronic illnesses. In some cases, they can progress to lethal illnesses. And so we're not talking about something that's some mild form or somebody else's problem. We're talking about something that could be your problem, and it could be your life.
Amen to that. Well, Dr. Nicholson, thank you so very much for being with us this evening, and we look forward to having you back on our program in the not-too-distant future.
Well, I'd love to come back.
Okay, God bless you. Good night. All right, that was Dr. Garth Nicholson. I hope you've enjoyed our interview with him this evening. If you'd like, of course, a copy of the entire hour-long tape, well, I would make it available by calling 1-800-544-8927 at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I have to remind our listeners out across America that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and everybody dependent on those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out across America 5 hours every day, and then we on a weekend program try to get people to understand we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men against truly wicked forces. And, of course, ultimately for the survival of Christian civilization. There are people who would destroy Christian civilization, and there were people who would destroy the sovereignty of our United States, and many of them are working at the highest levels of our government today. Now, certainly if you'd like to get the book, Project Daylily, or know more about it, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to begin to put a lot of this into its perspective, we do have a video, a talk I gave called Planned Population Reduction. That's Planned Population Reduction, and it's available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We actually have a 4-tape set on the Gulf War illness. We have a 4-tape set on population control. We have a video on population control. We've written the population control monograph, where we simply quote the people who talk about the importance, the vital importance of eliminating 90% of the world's population. We take you to Elberton, Georgia, and the great stone monument there, the American counterpart of the British Stonehenge, which is a great occult monument where they have satanic ceremonies. And I've been there on several occasions, and there, engraved in stone in 8 different languages, is the 10 commandments that come from the pit of hell. And point one is, maintain of the world population at 500 million in constant balance with nature. And people say nothing like that could happen. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I believe it can. I believe it's coming. I believe it's coming very, very rapidly. In fact, Barbara Mark Suppert, one of the wealthiest women in the world, wrote a book in the original manuscript, which we have copies of. She wrote about, her book was channeled to her by, I believe, a demonic spirit. She called it the Christ spirit. Told her that, you know, the Revelation 6:8, and look and behold a pale horse, and the rider upon him was death, and of course power was given unto them, and Hades followed close behind, and power was given to kill a quarter of the population of the world with by the sword, and by hunger, and by pestilence and death. And then she went on to talk about how there were people that just wouldn't evolve to the higher levels. They were about a quarter of the world. They were going to have to be eliminated. And then she went on to say, that is not your job, my dear. That is ours, for we are the riders of the pale horse, death. A woman who ran for the vice presidency of the United States in 1984, Democratic nomination against Geraldine Ferraro. There really are people out there like Jacques Cousteau who talked about the necessity of eliminating 365,000 people a day. If you'd like to verify what we're saying, we'll send you the pages from the UNESCO Courier in November of 1991. Call us at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Go to our website, radioliberty.com. You can listen to our internet programs 5 hours a day. And then tell other people about our program. Pray for America, pray for revival, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so till we're together again, may the Lord be with you.